First agenda item, Ground Fish Committee Report, tab 3. Three items under Ground Fish, perhaps more. Again, tab 3. Turn to the chair of the committee, Rip Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to say welcome to the non-existent Ground Fish Committee report. The committee has not met, but that doesn't mean that there have not been some items that staff has been working on. At our last, the November Council meeting, we tasked the staff with working on a rebuilding strategy for yellowtail flounder. The meeting materials for this are under tab number 3 as indicated, and the items are number 1 and 2 for this first presentation. We'll start out with a presentation from Tom on the yellowtail flounder. Our only council action would be either identification or narrowing down of alternatives, or possibly we could pick a preferred alternative. But that is our only action. After that, we will discuss the vessel buyback and go into some other items. So I'll turn it over to Tom.
Good morning. Back in November of 2009, the council voted to consider a new rebuilding strategy for Georgia's yellowtail flounder. I'm going to give just about the same presentation that I gave at the council meeting in January when we tried to discuss this right after the yellowtail discussion. I'm going to review the current rebuilding strategy for yellowtail, talk a little bit about a suggested process for it, and offer several alternatives. I'm hopeful that what I'd like to get out of this is the council will agree to the process, which you kind of did but really didn't do in January, and you may want to consider narrowing the alternatives that will be considered for the rebuilding strategy. There has not been a committee meeting, so there are no committee recommendations. Item number 1 in your binder is a PDT memo. If you notice carefully, it is slightly different than the PDT memo you saw in January, and I'll highlight what those differences are as we go through the presentation. To review the current strategy, the stock was declared overfished in 2005. We adopted a rebuilding strategy in Framework 42. The goal was to rebuild by 2014 at a 75% probability of success. We chose what we called the adaptive strategy, which is to fish at FMSY until 2009 and then adjust as necessary with an F rebuild. The original forecast for these F rebuilds were that we'd change to an F of somewhere between 0.135 and 0.16, and the current estimates, and to be clear, current means as of last summer. It doesn't mean anything newer than that. The estimates of the F rebuild were 0.02 to 0.085. So the question came, why are we changing the rebuilding strategy now in midstream? I think there's a couple reasons. The stock is improving. There are some buts with that I will go into here. The goal, I think, is to get some benefits from the rebuilding of the groundfish stock. And another not so minor goal is to facilitate cooperation with the Canadians on setting catch levels. The chart you see in front of you is from the assessment last year, where the stock is assessed annually through the track. At present, the track, and at present, I mean as of last year, the track was using two assessment runs that differed in how they treated a Canadian survey. Now, this is what's a little different from what I told you in January, and the change in the PDT memo is that it was clarified to me by some of the members of the assessment team that I had mischaracterized these model runs. The model runs were not, as I had said in January, equally possible, meaning no preference between them. The way they characterize these runs is they bracket reality. So that's a slightly different interpretation. We're hoping that will change this year, that there will only be one assessment run coming out. But I want to point out what the buts are. The TRAC noticed that, and this is a quote from the TRAC report last year, the status report, there's more uncertainty in this assessment than previous assessments than due to the survey data. The truncated age structure in the bottom trawl surveys and changes in distribution indicate current resource productivity is lower than historical levels. The PDT went on to point out when we set ABCs last year that several elements of this assessment suggest caution. First, the TRAC cautions the assessment is less certain than the past due to recent Canadian surveys. Second, while both model runs indicate rapidly increasing stock size since 2005, continued rapid growth is less certain because of poor recruitment in 2007. Third, since the end of the rebuilding period is approaching, projected rebuilding success is sensitive to estimates of recruits. And finally, the PDT looked at the assessment and said it may be acquiring a retrospective pattern when estimating fishing mortality. But even with those caveats, you can't ignore the fact that the stock is at levels that we probably haven't seen since the mid-70s, whether you look at the including or the excluding model run. This slide's a little different than what you saw last January. Ideally, we would consider narrowing the alternative strategies that will be considered today. In the real ideal world, we might consider picking a preferred alternative either in April or June. And I'll get into some reasons for that. July is the track assessment, and then we would have a final approval of the proposed action in the framework document in November of 2010. So you're probably wondering why, if we're not actually going to pick a final alternative until November of 2010, why am I suggesting narrowing the alternatives and even considering perhaps identifying a preferred alternative? That's in part to facilitate the U.S.-Canada process. If we narrow the alternatives, it will make it easier at the track to run projections that will feed into the management process. They'll know what options we are considering, and they'll be able to do some of those projections. In addition, when the SSC and the TMGC meet later this year, they will have an idea, at least, of how the rebuilding plan might change, and that may influence what they recommend for catch levels. So these are some of the reasons that would be helpful to try and accelerate this a little bit and narrow the alternatives that are being proposed. And as I said, which this may not actually be realistic, but also to try and get to a preferred alternative. So what the PDT did is we looked at the potential strategies. We use the term strategy to describe how we identify an end of a rebuilding period, you know, when we want to be accomplished, and what the probability of success is. That tends to define what fishing mortality rate you need as you go forward. The probability of success cannot be less than 50%. It actually has to be, you know, more than the median, more than 50%. And in recent years with groundfish stocks, we've used 75% as the goal for any strategy we adopted since Framework 42 and the Georgia's Bank Yellowtail Flounder. In Amendment 13, I think all the strategies were based on a median probability. So in simple terms, there's six possible rebuilding strategies given the probable ending dates and strategies that you may look at. I guess there's almost an infinite number if you consider these probabilities are continuous. But this doesn't really reflect the complexity that we have two assessment model runs right now, anyway, that bracket stock status. So we ran projections off comparing the six possible strategies and using the two different model runs as the basis for the projection. So one thing that all the details on the assumptions that we used in the projections are in the PDT report. These will obviously be updated after this year's track assessment, but that won't happen until July. We used the projections to compare the catch streams and rebuilding trajectories for the different strategies. In reality, when you do this, while you have six possible strategies, when you start looking at it, really there's only four of them that look to be reasonable. And I'll tell you why in just a second. The first is that if you start talking about the median probability and the maximum period, you really don't have any room for adjustment should rebuilding progress lag. What I mean by that is if you decide that you're going to go for 2016 and a 50% probability of success, if you find out in 2015 that you're falling behind, you don't have a lot of options left open to you about how to adjust for that last year. Second, if the excluding assessment is correct, and this is the one that would be at the low end of the bracket, then you really can't rebuild by 2014 with a 75% probability anymore. That's not possible. And if you're going to rebuild by 2015 with a 75% probability, at least with the information we have in front of you, it does not increase catches, which is bluntly seems to be the whole point of this exercise. So it narrows you down to really what we considered as four reasonable alternatives. We used the catch streams from the projections to compare the net present value of different strategies. We only considered yellowtail flounder revenues. We did not factor in the effect on the scallop fishery. We think in large measure the effect on the scallop fishery will scale the magnitude of the revenue impacts but won't change their relative relationship. Generally, if you give more if you allow people to catch more yellowtail, it has fewer adverse impacts on the scallop fishery. At some point, those benefits start to disappear because the scallop fishery is getting more than they need. But the other problem is we really don't know what the planned access areas are for the period 2012 to 2013, so we really can't get into a very detailed quantitative comparison between the alternatives. Generally, it might not be surprising, but median probability, because the catches tend to be higher, it tends to return higher net present value. Generally, the longer time periods return higher net present value. The differences over the 7 years of the projection that we ran are not huge. The difference between the high and the low is on the order of $10 to $12 million spread out over 7 years of the projection. So these are not gigantic differences between them. But the ranking is shown on your slide. The PDT looked at this information. We did not come up with a recommendation. We felt there was little objective basis for preferring an alternative at this point. Initially, the PDT, and the PDT still does, suggest waiting for the 2000 assessment to provide additional information. However, while all that's true, the council may have some policy reasons to try and narrow down the list of alternatives and may want to consider identifying a preferred. As I pointed out, one reason to narrow the alternatives is to facilitate the TRAC and TMGC process. The TMGC will probably meet before the September council meeting, so it would be useful for them to know what rebuilding strategies we're at least looking at so they can structure their catch recommendation. As I pointed out, it might be ideal if the council identified a preferred strategy before they meet, which would mean you'd have to identify one at either this meeting or the June meeting. But we recognize that this might be difficult without knowing the updated stock status. And I can't answer any questions. That completes my presentation.
Dave Pepp.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple of questions, Tom. With the including model run, you're including the outsized toes in the Canadian assessment. And with these outliers, I was at the track meeting 2 years ago where that first outlier toe was announced. And I asked the question at that time what the age structure was in that outlier toe, that really tremendously high toe. And at that time, they said that the age structure was spread across almost all year classes, that it wasn't, that it was obviously not a single spawning event. That it was across several age structures, which would indicate to me that it probably should be included. I don't know what happened with the outliers the following year. Do you have any information on that? I have two questions. It's the first one.
I don't have any information on the outlier year. I just want to be a little bit more clear about the treatment of the large toes. What the assessment did is they ran for the The difference between the two assessments is how they treated the survey in the years with the large toes. In the excluding assessment, they didn't just exclude the large toes. They didn't add the survey information for that year. And then in the including, they used all the survey information for that year. So this isn't a question of cherry-picking which toes they're going to use in the assessment for that given year. And their, as I understand it, their preferred way to deal with this type of issue is to have a weighting factor for the survey in those years where they have unusual toes. But I believe it was an issue that they didn't really have the software to do that last year. And I think this year that they're planning to have it available to do it. Now, I'm going out on a limb a little bit here, so Jim may want to weigh in on that end of it. But I know from talking to them that they think they're going to be able to deal with those that information in a different way this year than they had to the last 2 years, so that they'll only hopefully have one model run coming out of it.
Okay, that would be very useful. It's a very troubling situation. The second thing I wanted to point out was that in the NAFL regulatory area, yellowtail flounder have been increasing rather rapidly. And in fact, for Area 3 LN and O this year, the science advisors said that for those three areas that we could go to a TAC of 24,000 tons, which is really a surprising recovery in that area. And I don't know if that has any bearing here, but it would appear that at least out there on the Grand Banks, that there's been an enormous increase in the population of yellowtail flounder. And when I put that together with the outliers that are on the eastern edge of our area, or the Canadian area, it makes me very, very leery of holding the TAC down by not including that data. I'm very troubled by this. I don't know which way to go with it, but I'm very leery of not opening it up rather extensively, really.
Dr. Jim?
Thank you. I don't have any additional information about what new programs will be available next summer, so I can't comment on that. But one thing that I wanted to add to this, Tom, if you already said this, I missed it, so forgive me, but I wanted to put into perspective what the current biomass estimates are relative to the biomass rebuilding target. And the target is about 43,000 metric tons. And the values that the two models come in at for the current biomass are at about 50% of that. So the perspective I'm trying to add is that there's still quite a ways to go to get rebuilt.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, to Jim's point, assessment considerations. I'm optimistic that when the next assessment is done, we'll see some very good news regarding the status of the stock, that the status will be much better than we think it is. And the reason why I feel that way is that I was present when council staffer Jessica Megley defended her thesis. Thesis committee comprised of many Northeast Fishery Science Center scientists. Very informative work, very optimistic results that will be, as I understand it, incorporated into the upcoming assessment. So, Tom, a question of you. Are you familiar with what the assessment will involve relative to that work done by Jessica? And does the plan development team have any early reaction to that particular information that might make the PDT feel optimistic that the biomass estimate will be higher and will be closer to the target than we think we are right now?
Well, I don't have any. The plan development team has not talked about it. I'm have a passing acquaintance with the paper that David's referring to. It was discussed during Yellowtail Flounder Working Group, informal working group, several weeks ago. It's not clear to me that it's going to lead at this point to a vastly different picture of the stock status. In the working group, and granted this was just a working group, it wasn't the follow-on, the paper was discussed and the results of the paper were believed to be relatively consistent with the assessment results that we saw last year. There's going to be further discussion of it, but it's not clear to me that it's going to lead to a dramatically different picture of the stock.
But might it result in support for the Canadian estimate, in other words, including the Canadian view regarding George's Bank Yellowtail. My impression is that it will contribute towards a favoring of the Canadian position, that is, stock status is much better than what we think it is.
Well, I think that's a mischaracterization, to be honest. There is no Canadian position of what the stock status is. There is an agreed-upon track assessment that was agreed upon by the U.S. and Canadian scientists that both say and both agree on what the fishing mortality rate and what the stock size is, at least bracketed by those two model runs. And neither the Canadians or the U.S. scientists that I'm aware of have taken a position that says they prefer one or the other of those brackets. So the idea that there's a Canadian position on what the stock looks like and a U.S. position, I think, is just flat wrong. There is a position on what the status of the stock is. Where the difference comes in is in how the two management systems react to that stock status. Because of our rebuilding requirements and our selected rebuilding strategy, we have chosen to keep our catches at fairly low levels. The Canadians, on the other hand, are not tied into that same Magnuson Act requirement, and so they feel that they can be more liberal with their catches. As seen from this presentation, if you modify the rebuilding strategy, your catches probably would be higher and would be more in line. But I just want to make it clear, there's no Canadian or U.S. position on stock status. What there is a Canadian and U.S. difference on how you react to the current assessment results.
Anyone else on the council? Jimmy.
Yeah, I'd like to make a motion that we eliminate the runs for 2014 and 2015, both for the excluding run and the including run, and that we add a run for 2016 at a 60% probability. That's the motion.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Preble. Dr. Pierce.
If I might, we have before us the different options suggested by the plan development team as being reasonable, and we're looking at a 75% probability year 2016 as one of the options. So I just wonder why Jim is picking 60% as opposed to the 75%.
Jimmy.
Yeah, the 75% doesn't get us... It gets us very little increased catch, and it's just if I don't have this exact, but I think looking at the Canadian strategy, if we pick 60%, it will line up pretty close to what the Canadian strategy is, and will allow us to come to a better agreement in the TMGC negotiations, but. We won't know that till we run it. You know, that's just picking a number out on the graph. So that's why I'm asking to run it, and at least we will be able to see what it does.
To the motion on the board?
Yeah, I don't think we quite got it right yet.
Okay. Jim, can you take a look at the motion and make sure it captures what you said?
Yeah, I want to exclude the runs for 2014 and 2015, and then add a run for 2016 at a 60% probability. That's correct. So,
thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Preble.
Yeah, I strongly support this motion. I think that we need to, for a number of reasons, we need to come more in line with the Canadian point of view on this. And this motion does that without putting us outside of the requirements of Magnuson. So I think that we need to do at least this much. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, since the intent of this is to narrow the alternatives, essentially what we've done here, does that accomplish that in terms of what you need to do?
Well, I think so. I mean, you dropped basically the 2 years and two runs per year from 2014 and 15. And then you go to 2016 and you have, the way I'm interpreting this is to go forward with a 60% and a 75% probability.
And the 50.
And the 50. Right. Well, in that case, you're still.
It does eliminate. It eliminates, I think, three runs.
Yeah, I'm not counting right then, because I think we it gives you. Well, you add two. Yeah, okay, so it should narrow.
Anyone else on the council? Doug Grout.
Would this mean that we would not have a status quo run here? Means if we're going to make any decisions, we're completely eliminating the status quo run because we're not doing the 2014 at the current 2014 at 75%. Is that the case?
I think we would still have to have the no action alternative if for no other reason than NEPA reasons.
Anyone else on the council? Go to the audience. Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz, Fishery Survival Fund. We strongly support this motion. I think this is a step in the right direction. And just one point I'd like to make. Last year, I had over a dozen research trips offshore in yellowtail territory, and we had some very high catch rates of yellowtail. Since the March 1st opening, I'm getting reports back from scallopers that the yellowtail are in much larger quantities than last year, and not only that, they're way to the westward. They've spread out. They're in southern New England, both sides of the Hudson Canyon. We're seeing a real explosion of yellowtail out there, and I have concerns that the new survey trawl on the Bigelow with the roller gear will not pick up these yellowtail. We had a similar problem in the late 70s with the albatross trawl. So there are yellowtail there. The council should be very comfortable with that, and it's actually going to be a real bycatch problem in all fisheries. Thank you.
Richie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I'd like to read a letter from our Mayor Scott Lang out of New Bedford. He wasn't able to make it here today, and he asked me to present it. I forwarded a copy to the council. Dear Mr. Papalotto, thank you for your attention. As the mayor of the number one fishing port in the nation, I write to you today to express my grave concern with the management of the fisheries in New England. The Bedford fishing industry creates $1 billion economic impact on the region and employs over 4,000 people. New Bedford is a full-service port with over 200 businesses that support the commercial fishing industry, the jobs, as well as the tax base the businesses provide are directly tied to the vitality of the fishing industry. As a result of the lack of the comprehensive assessment of the socioeconomic impacts of the council's management system, as required under Rule 8 of the Sustainable Fisheries Act, the council continues to make decisions that threaten our employment, our economy, our working waterfront infrastructure, and our fishermen and their families. In short, the New England Fishery Management Council policies negatively affect people without the council having any clear understanding of the real impact its policies have on the social fabric of New England's ports. On the topic of your meeting, I ask that you consider the follow response actions on of the frameworks for skate and yellowtail. The skate reduction of skates from 20,000 pounds to 1,900 pounds, an enormously drastic measure of 90.5% reduction. Reduction of this magnitude will have irreversible harm on the economy, sustainability of fishing communities, and its core violates National Standard Rule 8 that requires the consideration of social economic impacts of your actions. Forecasts suggest this will result in a loss of about 300 jobs in New Bedford alone. The postponed cuts come at a time when New Bedford is digging out of one of the worst economic downturns in history and grapples with an unemployment rate of 11.8%. This is no time to make decisions of this scale. The small token increase to 5,000 pounds, a 75% reduction, while appreciated, will not be sufficient given the enormity of the challenges confronting the New England fishing industry due to the CAT Shares Sector Management Program that takes effect on May 1st, 2010. Second is the yellowtail flounder. 16 U.S. Code Section 1854, the Magnuson Act, requires the rebuilding of stocks at a minimum of 10 years. The Council has voted to rebuild the yellowtail stocks in 7 years. The entire issue associated with yellowtail landings could be resolved with a vote to rebuild yellowtails in 10 years. Also, analysis the current data on yellowtail stock assessments may alleviate some of the pressure of the groundfish and scallop industry as well. I would like to reemphasize my position as noted in my letters on March 22, 2010 and on April 20, 2010, urging a temporary delay on cap share sectors for groundfish while current data is re-evaluated and allocated to provide scientific sound and rational catch limits. Please note my strong opposition to the integration of a catch share sector management system between groundfish and scallop fisheries. New Bedford's billion-dollar commercial fishing industry should not be penalized to the point of catastrophic loss over the bycatch of yellowtail. The sustainability of all the New England fishing communities is being threatened by a management system that is not ready to be implemented. I urge you to take a step back and identify both the intent and the unintended effects of the system that does not have appropriate species allocations under the law and ignores the real threat to sustainability of people who make their living in the fishing industry. Respectfully submitted, Mayor New Bedford Scott Lang. Thank you for that. On another note, on the yellowtail issue, just 4 weeks ago, we increased the landings on yellowtail. We're about 80% on the U.S.-Canada sharing agreement. And I made a few calls of trying to get them increased, and they were increased to 5,000 pounds. 20%, roughly 20%, was landed in 4 weeks. We were about 80%. So we say between 15 and 20%. Was landed at yellowtails of 4 weeks, and that's pretty huge. I got a, if I may, I just got an email from the fishing vessel Buzzards Bay. He's offshore. He's fishing. You know, he came in last night. This came on the 27th. Hey, Rich. It says groundfish meet in April 28th, 8:30, discuss strategies to rebuild Georgia Bank yellowtails. Somebody, please tell them if we can get 50 bushel of tow everywhere, no strategy needed. These guys right now are just discarding 50 bushel. 50 bushel is about 80 pounds per bushel. It's about 4,000 pounds overboard. They cannot get away from this species. We had a problem in 2004 when we had that derby going out for it. We have a reverse effect now. Let's not make the same mistake twice. And and how it affects our scallop industry is—it's just another mess we're going to have to deal with later on this afternoon, I guess, with the Joint Species Committee. It's just a mess. Again, we're being regulated by the weakest link, and both fisheries being yellowtail. There's a lot of fish out there. There's a lot of yellowtail. These guys are discarding them. So please be lenient on the fishermen and let them be profitable. Thanks.
Anyone else? Back to the council. A motion on the board. Anything further? Sally.
Good. We just have a clarification on the timing of this. So if this motion goes forward, which, by the way, I will support this so that we have the range of options on the table. My assumption is that then the stock assessment happens and we're able to discuss this again at the end of June. But what beyond that as far as actually getting this change on the books, whichever alternative might be selected, whether it's status quo or any of the other three that might be included in this alternative, when would this actually go into effect? Sorry if I missed it, but I'd like to hear it again if I did miss it.
First, the stock assessment will not be completed before the June council meeting. The TRAC meeting is scheduled for mid-July. But whatever decision the council makes, the plan was to submit it in a framework action at the end of the year, and then it would be implemented on May 1st of 2011.
Anyone else on the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous, 17. Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom, do we need to do something with having the council start a framework for this now?
No, we're going to have to start a framework at some point, but I think we got time to do that. And there may be some other issues later today that come up related to that.
We can always add to the framework. Okay, thank you, Tom. I guess we will move right into the multi-species vessel buyback presentation. Ann?
Hey, this is a presentation I gave at the Maine Fishermen's Forum in March, and there's been a lot of talk about the possibility of having a buyback for the groundfish fleet, so I've been asked to give it again for the full council. When it comes up, we had originally had a motion last year to look at a groundfish buyback this year, but then when we revisited priorities again, the interspecies ended up not taking up the buyback at this time. An overview of the presentation. I'm going to briefly go over the status of the fishery through 2008, the groundfish fishery, and then give an overview of the Magnuson-Stevens Act requirements for a buyout, a brief history of buyouts that have previously occurred in New England, and then an overview of recent buyouts elsewhere in the U.S. Studies have suggested that there's an overcapitalization of the groundfish fleet. A buyout would be one way to address the overcapitalization. There are other ways. And goals and vision for the fleet would matter in the design of a buyout. Goals could include having high profitability for a few participants, or lower profitability for more participants, preserving historical access, those types of issues. I won't talk about design issues for a buyout, but rather the regulatory requirements. I think members of the council have probably seen most of these charts, but just to go over them quickly, this is groundfish landings and revenues from 2001 through 2008. The red bar there is revenues in constant dollars, which you can see are decreasing from about 100,000 in 2001 to just about $70,000 in 2008. And the blue line is groundfish landed in live weight, which has been increasing from 2006 through 2008, even with fewer days at sea in those years. This is multi-species days at sea permits. The top line is total days at sea permits, and the bottom line is permits that are using days at sea. For the permits using days at sea, it was right about 1,000 in 1996, and we're down to about 500 permits using days at sea in 2008. This is multi-species days at sea trends. The blue line is days at sea that have been allocated. That's the lower line. It's kind of hard to see the colors. And the upper line is days at sea charged, which have been relatively constant from about 2005 through 2008. This is mortality trends on the groundfish stocks. Measures quintiles within the stocks across years. Red means that there's the highest mortality among the time series, so black is good anyway. And biomass trends. The inset is showing biomass trends for the groundfish stocks without haddock and redfish, I believe. And the bottom line is showing all of the groundfish stocks. Here's the chart of the stock status under the GARM 3. The bottom right block is where we want the stocks to be. That's not overfished, and no overfishing is occurring. We've got a few stocks down there, but we still have a lot up in the upper left-hand side, which is overfished and overfishing occurring. There's several different types of buyouts, industry-funded buyouts versus subsidized buyouts. And there's buyouts that can happen under the Magnuson framework and buyouts that could happen under special legislation. To date, no buyout has been conducted completely under the Magnuson framework, although it is laid out in there pretty clearly what would need to happen for a buyout to occur. And you can have buyouts for capacity reduction or for the sake of disaster assistance under Magnuson. The first step in designing or implementing a buyout is a business plan, which is prepared by industry and specifies a detailed reduction methodology. It has to include the capacity reduction specifications and is accompanied by environmental, economic, and social analyses. The economic analyses project the fishery value. They have to show that the loan could be repaid and that the economic benefits could be achieved by the buyout. It has to show maximum sustained reduction in fishing capacity at the least cost in the minimum amount of time. And it has to detail ways in which it'll prevent replacement of removed capacity once the capacity is removed, through moratorium on new entrants, restrictions on vessel upgrades, and or other effort control measures. The bottom line here is that it's really, really detailed what needs to be in this business plan, and that it is something that's prepared by industry and then brought to the council for approval under Magnuson, generally not the other way around. There's very specific requirements on what types of loans can be issued, limits on the amount of the loan based on the projected delivery, limits on the interest rates and all that kind of stuff is laid out in there very, very specifically. And I'm not going to go into all the details because it is very detailed under Magnuson. The next step in the buyback would be the request, which includes all the key aspects of the business plan. The council would make the request to NMFS, and then NMFS would hold a public hearing. And the request includes an actual reduction amendment that the council would prepare or an endorsement, at least, of amendment specifications. The aspects of the request include it projects the amounts of the reduction, detailed sources of funding for the reduction, demonstrates that the buyback will achieve conservation goals and prevent the capacity from being replaced, And it also lists who the permit holders are and what the landings are over the last 5 years, including the names and addresses of all permit and vessel owners. And it's going to detail the criteria for eligibility for the buyout. And then NOAA reviews the request once it's received, invites public comment, and analyzes for conservation objectives, and then holds hearings in every state and provides a detailed implementation plan with extensive details on all parts of the procedure that were in the original business plan. After the request, a referendum would be held. The permit holders receive ballots from NOAA, and two-thirds of the ones that vote have to approve the buyback program. If it fails, it either gets sent back to NOAA or the buyback is off the table. The business plan itself specifies who's eligible for the referendum, and it could be limited to a particular gear type within the fishery, or otherwise limited by the size of the vessel, geographic area. It doesn't have to cover the entire fleet. It would have to be determined whether the buyback was only for permits or whether it was for permits and vessels. And after the referendum, if it goes through, then the bids become irrevocable, and they're scored and ranked according to the implementation plan, and the fee structure is determined. This is a chart from Leo Irwin at the Regional Office of Financial Services with estimates of how long it would take to conduct a buyback. The business plan takes, on average, maybe 270 days to prepare, and the total days that it would take on average to conduct a buyback from the time of starting the business plan and through the time when the actual permits are bought is 1,125 days. So that's, 4 years. There's been a few buyback programs previously in New England, two, in fact. The fishing vessel buyback program was conducted in two stages. It was, in essence, a demonstration project and removed vessels and permits. And then the permit buyout followed 3 years later with the explicit goal of reducing latent effort in the fishery. The fishing vessel buyout, which was the first step, required owners to surrender vessels and permits. Only limited access permit holders that demonstrated significant reliance on ground fish were eligible. And a reverse auction was conducted with bids ranked by the ratio of the bid to the average ground fish revenues. In the end, 79 vessels were removed under this program at a total cost of $25 million rather. In two phases, there was the pilot buyout in which 11 vessels were removed, and then 2 years later, the expanded buyout. And the second buyout program, which was the permit buyout, didn't require owners to surrender their vessels, and there was no requirement to demonstrate reliance on ground fish revenues, in contrast to the first one. Vessel capacity was estimated and bids were ranked in order of the amount of capacity removed per dollar of buyout money. And ultimately, 245 permits were removed for $9.6 million. Generally, the permits were from smaller vessels than the vessels that were removed during the vessel buyback that preceded this. Lessons learned from the buyout were that these two combined programs removed about 20% of the capacity output from the ground fish fishery. They were more effective when capacity-based selection criteria were used. And both of these programs were the result of special legislation. They weren't done under the Magnuson Act buyout provisions. Just a brief mention of a few other buyouts that have occurred in the U.S. NOAA funded $46 million in disaster assistance buybacks for Pacific salmon, Texas shrimp, and I think that's Long Island lobster. There's $90 million NOAA buyback of Bering Sea Aleutian Islands pollock, which was also authorized under special legislation. It was 83% financed. And Bering Sea crab and Pacific groundfish buyouts. But none of these were fully implemented under the Magnuson Act. In summary, there's a few different types of buyouts under Magnuson or through special legislation. The Magnuson framework is initiated by industry, although the council does get involved at the step of the request to NIMS. It's a very complex and time-consuming process, which requires a business plan, referendum, and many other steps. The past New England buyouts removed 79 vessels at $25 million and then 245 permits at $10 million. And no buyouts been implemented completely under Magnuson in the U.S. to date.
That's it. Questions?
Thanks, Annie. Questions for Annie? David?
I think actually more, it's probably more a couple questions for Pat. If Congress appropriates the money for a buyout, it doesn't have to go through that NOAA process, right? It doesn't have to go through that four-year process?
That's right.
Okay. And if, now how about if there's money in NOAA and that is moved to a buyout, does that have to go through that process?
I believe so, because the when they appropriate the funding, they give us the authority to use it for that purpose.
Okay, I'm just trying to think of how. I mean, 4 years is too long. In 4 years, I don't know who you'll be mailing the check to, but it's probably a bankruptcy judge or something. I mean, it's not going to be to the guy who owns the boat. So if we're going to do something, we have to do it in some way that's way faster than this, a year, year and a half tops. So that's all I'm trying to, because people in Congress are asking questions and trying to get them the answers. Thank you.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you indicated that nobody has sort of gone to completion on one of these buyouts yet. Where did the average number of days that it would take to do that come from? Somebody must have gotten pretty well through the process and in order to come up with those.
Yeah, I think some of the ones that were authorized by special legislation did use some of the Magnuson framework as a backdrop to the buyout, and so it might have been coming from that. But I don't know, because I wasn't involved in that calculation, but I think they just looked at process-wise and just in terms of getting the data and getting the money secured.
Anyone else on the council? Jimmy?
I guess this is a question to the chairman, and that is, you know, I guess we cannot ask Congress for money or the Senate. So, but in the same token, I think we need to find a way to at least send a message that we, this body, thinks, and I'm assuming that we do think that, but if we do think that we need a buyback in this region, can we send a letter to Congress to just say that we feel that there needs to be a buyback? Is that past our? I see Pat shaking her head no. But anyway, that's the question I have: is can we ask? Can we tell somebody there's a need, and with our backing that we see the need? That's one of my question.
I'll ask Gene, but my understanding is that on matters like this, the only time we can get involved is if we're asked our opinions.
Yeah, it's
so if somebody were to say to the somebody were asked the council in correspondence, what are your opinions or feelings about this, then they've initiated the conversation and asked us for a consult on the topic. But if I have it wrong, Gene, correct
that's
me.
Correct, and the law that doesn't allow you to lobby doesn't apply just to funding. It applies to any kind of lobbying, including new legislation. The idea is that you can't use appropriated funds from the government to lobby Congress, which at least indirectly that would be involved if the council asked or lobbied for new legislation or new appropriations.
Right, but if we were asked, our opinion
right.
is different.
If they ask your opinion, you can give it.
Jimmy.
And of course, individual council members can lobby on their own behalf for this, as long as they're not speaking or representing that they're speaking for the council.
Jimmy.
Okay, another question then. Could we write a letter to the Secretary of Commerce and outlining that we think there's a need for a buyback instead of Congress? That's the next question. I think we can do that.
You mean outside the buyback provisions? I mean, there are the majesty, I mean, there are.
Let me repackage Jim's question. Is there a way that the council could indicate a need to the Secretary of Commerce concerning capacity reduction in the fishery?
Outside the what's in the Madison Act for Commerce to look for something outside what's already legally authorized? No.
I don't think he said Congress. He said the Secretary of
Commerce. Department of Commerce is legally authorized to do. No, they couldn't. I mean, it's not as if we aren't aware of the concerns through this council meeting.
Jimmy.
I'm sorry, I didn't get what the answer was. I just couldn't.
Well, what would you be asking for Commerce to seek a method to do this outside what's already authorized in the Madison Act?
Yes, what I would want to do is just express the need for one and let the Secretary of Commerce figure out a way, if possible, to get it. So we would just be sending a letter saying that this body feels there is a need for a buyback.
Well, I mean, I guess if it's that neutral, perhaps that's okay. But again, there is a mechanism in place for the council to initiate a buyback.
Rodney.
Yeah, thank you. This is probably for Gene, this question. So if two members of the audience come up to that mic and ask us to write a letter to the Secretary of Commerce that they request a buyback, then we could have that discussion. Is that what you're telling us?
No. I'm not sure what difference it makes whether two members of the audience come up and ask for it.
Well, any two members of the audience get up and say, we're going to go out of business. We need a buyback. Could we then have that discussion? And at the end of that discussion, could we formalize a letter and send that? That's what I'm asking.
Well, you could have the discussion. It doesn't depend on whether members in the audience come up and ask you for it. I think it's probably appropriate just to summarize the discussion and send it to the notice of the Secretary of Commerce, as long as you don't lobby for Congress to either develop new legislation to specifically help the council or to appropriate funds to allow for the buyback.
Pat.
When John was talking about being requested, it's being requested by a member of Congress for the council's opinion. So you can't express a position unless you've been requested by a member of Congress on what the council's position would be. I think you could send a letter that was carefully worded that basically says we think there's a need for a buyback program, or one potential solution to the problems we see in the groundfish fishery is a buyback, and we would urge you to support it, or something like that, with being completely silent on how, when, where.
Now, Rodney, if you were to say get your congressman to ask the council its opinion. Jimmy.
Yeah, I think I'd like to make a motion that this council send a letter to the Secretary of Commerce, carefully worded, that says that we feel there is a need for a permit buyback in the multi-species fisheries here in New England. Period.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dr. Pierce. Gene, I have a question. What happens if I don't word the letter carefully? Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would suggest just one slight wording change. Instead of saying that the council feels a need, that the council recognizes a need.
Seconder, maker and seconder. Don't object. Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, Jim, do you want to say just a permit buyback or a permit and bulk buyback?
Well, I don't think any of the buybacks have ever actually bought boats, so I don't think we need a boat buyback. I don't think that's possible. They have, yeah, I want to leave it at just permits. There has been no boat buybacks in the United States that I know about. There's all permit buybacks with restrictions on what happens to the boat.
See, I think the very first ground fish, I think it was the pilot, it did buy vessels, but on a very small level. Anyone else on the council to the motion on the board? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Fifteen opposed. Abstentions. One abstention. The motion carries 15-0 with one abstention. Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ann, for that presentation. Tom, do we want to get into our next item, which is addressing applications for additional sectors which have been received by the council?
We received two letters requesting additional sectors be implemented in fishing year 2011. This was not an issue that was raised during the council priorities discussion in November, so the council needs to decide what management action or what timing they want to consider these two applications on, what schedule they want to use for these two applications. The requests are in your binder. I really hadn't planned on going into them in any detail today. The issue is just, are we going to consider these requests this year for implementing in 2011? And if so, what sort of timing do you want to do it on? And which committee, the non-existent ground fish committee or some other committee, will be the one that reviews the particular proposals and makes recommendations to the council? As I mentioned a little while ago, we are planning to have a framework action probably at the November council meeting would be the final meeting. Initially right now, anyway, it's planned to change the Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder rebuilding strategy. So it's at least conceivable that if you're looking for a management action that could consider additional sectors, that might be the appropriate management action. Just to review the process a little bit, Amendment 13 and Amendment 16 spell out that if you want to request an additional sector, you have to submit your request to the council by May 1st, or actually what it says is by a year before you plan to operate, which with our fishing year is May 1st. And then it's up to the council to decide which management action they want to put that forward in. Amendment 13 talks about it as if we're going to do it during the normal biennial adjustment process, which would be every 2 years. But, of course, the council can choose to initiate a framework to do this type of thing whenever they particularly want to. I will point out that at least my initial review of one of the applications, I'm having trouble really trying to figure out why they submitted it, because it appears that they just want to continue to operate in 2011 the way they are operating now, more or less. That doesn't require them to resubmit and re-ask. So, you know, we'll clarify that over the next couple months, and it may turn out that there's really only one request rather than two requests to go forward.
Tom, from your standpoint, a process could be that we just make a motion here to put these sector requests into the next available framework?
Yes.
I would so move.
Seconded by Terry Stockwell. Discussion? Mr. Libby?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Question, if Would this be needed to go with the potential, and I stress potential, scallop bycatch sectors?
No, I think it's you would probably want to keep them separate for a couple reasons. Assuming that we develop scallop bycatch sectors, that's going to take an amendment to the scallop plan and an amendment to the groundfish plan. We can, which will quite possibly include an EIS accompanying that amendment, which would be a longer process. Sectors, we can implement additional sectors through a framework, generally with an EA, so we can do them more quickly. So I think there's some good reasons to keep those two issues perhaps in separate actions. If for no other reason than if you really want to get these guys operating by 2011, I'm not sure the joint scallop groundfish amendment would be completed by then.
Anyone else on the council? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous. Rip.
All right, we'll turn it back over to Tom for discussion on the Pollock ABC planning.
This will just be a very brief introduction. I think most of you know that, and I'm not sure it actually will require any council action today, but we just wanted to update you on and elaborate a little bit on some of the discussions that were held at the executive committee meeting. The Pollock is undergoing an assessment. The final assessment meetings will be held the first week of June with a stock assessment. The SARC will be held the first week of June. The SARC results will probably be officially available sometime in probably late July by the time everything's published, late July, early part of August. There's been a lot of interest expressed that depending on the results of the assessment, should the results suggest that the Pollock ABC could be higher in 2010, that the ABC should be changed for this fishing year. So we've tried to think a little bit about how that process would work. It's our understanding, and we may be corrected by the service on this at this particular meeting, but it's our understanding or expectation that if you want to change the ABC, that you're probably going to have the SSC weigh in and say what the acceptable biological catch should be. With the assessment results being released in the middle of the summer, you start to get into a little bit of a timing problem in that, assuming you schedule an SSC meeting for some time in after the assessment results are final, so let's say August or early September, then the results don't really come back to the council until September, and so the council doesn't make a decision on what the annual catch limit should be based on the new ABC until September, and so then you have some implementation time in order for this to get over to the service and to publish whatever documents or regulatory changes need to be done, assuming one can be done in season. So it starts to drag on where you're not changing the ABC till October, November, December. So in order to expedite this, we think that we're going to try and come back to the council in June with some need for action to provide some guidance to the SSC on what your risk tolerance is for pollock, and to also perhaps request some sort of action from the service based on the results of the SSC meeting. So this is a little bit of a leap of faith for council members, perhaps, in that the SSC, if you want this to happen as quickly as possible, you're basically going to want the service to take the results from the SSC meeting and run with them, perhaps before you've actually had a chance to see what the results from the SSC meeting are. But we just wanted to alert you to this fact. There is a chance that by the June council meeting we will have at least some information from the Pollock assessment, though the results will not be final yet. So you may have at least some idea of the directionality of what we're talking about here for any change to the ABC and maybe some sense of what the relative magnitude is. But I want to be clear that you're not going to know the final numbers because the assessment results will not be final until all the reviewers submit their paperwork and the report is published around late July. But we just wanted to give you a heads up for that and to alert you to that and to spell out the process that we're kind of looking at. I don't know if the service wants to weigh in on that idea or not, or if they see ways to make it even quicker, but you know, that was what our thinking was.
Pat?
Well, we did have this conversation at the executive committee meeting as well. It's our intention to, if appropriate, move forward as quickly as possible with the Pollock information. We don't need the SSC to meet for us to take some kind of action. Obviously, the council would need the SSC advice for them to move forward with any kind of action. If we did take an action, the council would have to follow that action up anyway to put something in place on a longer-term basis. So in general, I think, that's the process we've all been discussing. One caveat about the SSC.
Mary Beth.
Just to sort of clarify some of Pat's comments here, I'm assuming that when you say that you can take some action, that you would be considering emergency action, and the council follow-up would be a regulatory action with a proposed rule and final rule that would reinforce that action. Is that what you're thinking?
Well, if the results of the assessment indicate that it's appropriate to take emergency action, that's one of the options we'd be considering anyway. And yes, the council would have to follow that up.
So listening to Tom's comments and sort of reading through the executive committee's summary, I guess the question is whether or not we as a body would try to front load moving that process forward, or if it's really necessary, if you have the authority to take the emergency action, maybe we're just good with that.
I don't really understand the question. The council needs to take action on the Pollock assessment if it's appropriate. So the council should be thinking about what action they'd be taking and initiating that action now.
I mean, I think everybody understands the concern that some vessels have allocations that they have said could result in a single tow would be, the end of the year for that particular vessel. So, I mean, that's our concern. So we would want something in place in as timely a fashion as we could possibly do it. And I guess I don't really have a question.
Tom.
Well, so to revise what I said based on Pat's input, then in June, there really won't be any, well, let me correct that. In the summer, there won't be any need for the SSC to meet to consider changing the 2010 Pollock ABC. But based on the results of the assessment, the SSC may need to meet to consider changing the ABCs for 2011 and 2012. That actually helps us out on the staff because we were having some problems scheduling the SSC meetings. It also means that I think that the council in June will not have to request an emergency action from the service or some sort of action. It sounds like the service is prepared to do that. But we may still in June, when we're talking about 2011 and 2012, want to develop some information that gives some guidance to the SSC so that when they meet in August or September
and start working on ABCs for Pollock for 2011 and 2012. They know what they're working on. But it certainly does simplify our process if the SSC doesn't have to do anything for the 2010 change.
The potential vehicle for that change from the council's perspective would be the same action that the Yellowtail rebuilding strategy and the other issues.
Yeah, there's actually, yes, that's probably what we'd do is bundle that all together. I mean, technically we could probably change the Pollock ABC through a specs package, but why do two things when we're already doing another one?
That's right. Okay. Mr. Libby.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I guess this is a question for Pat. If there is an emergency action for Pollock, like it sounds there will be, do you know what the timeline might be for that?
No, I don't.
Anyone else? Okay, Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe that ends the business that we had discussed with staff. I do believe that there are some council members who have some other business to bring forward under Groundfish.
Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have three issues I'd like to talk about. Two of them are letters that are in our binders. And the first one is from the Portland Fish Exchange. It's number 10H. And Burke Jorgensen, the general manager of the exchange, is here. And I'd like to ask your indulgence to let him explain to us his letter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Recently, I submitted a letter to the council requesting an exemption to the dockside monitoring rules in the Amendment 16. I've received numbers of requests from our seller base requesting that the Portland Fish Exchange be able to provide dockside monitoring services. Currently, we are precluded from providing those services or applying to become a dockside monitor because of our dealer permit. I'd like to explain to the council that the Portland Fish Exchange has a very unusual business model. For those of you that may not know of the exchange has been in business since 1986. The exchange is a public quasi-corporation owned by the City of Portland that is overseen by a board of directors. Our board of directors is comprised of two sellers, two buyers, two representatives of the City of Portland, and two public members. So we have a very strong organizational leadership that manages the operation of the exchange. The exchange has always operated in a very transparent and a very unbiased manner. And being a very unbiased provider of services between the buyer and the seller of the groundfish. Given this unusual composition, I'm here to ask for an exemption to the rule allowing the Portland Fish Exchange to pursue certification as a dockside monitor.
Okay, thanks, Bert. I've read your letter. Tab 3, enclosure 10H, for those that haven't. You've made your request, your letter's in the binder. Entertain anything from a council member at this time concerning this issue? Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Bert only went so far in underscoring that the quasi-public entity in the fact that they don't take custody of the fish. Given the remoteness of Maine and separation of the down east ports from the rest of the of New England, I'd like to make a move to support the fish exchange's request for an exemption in section 4.2.3.5.4 the standards for sector monitoring and reporting service providers from Amendment 16. Tell me where you are, Karen. Okay. Request for an exemption, section, and reporting service. Providers from Amendment 16.
Is there a second? Seconded by Mary Beth. So, Terry, just so I'm clear, the intent of the motion is for the council to draft a letter supporting this request to the service?
To the service.
Okay. Discussion? Pat?
Sorry, this is a change to the plan. This is not a request. We can't exempt them from the standards.
That's why I asked for clarification on the intent from the maker. He said it was to write a letter to you asking you to exempt them. Apparently that's something the council needs to do. It's in the regs. Terry?
So if it's in the regs, then I guess the we were just talking about having an action. I can see another addition to it.
So you want to amend your motion to include this request for exemption in the next available action?
It doesn't look like I have any other. There's no other possibility of moving it ahead today, so I think that would make that amended motion make sense.
Seconder agree? Seconder agrees. Okay. Discussion? David?
Yeah, I'd like to ask the maker and the seconder if they consider adding, since it's going to have to be an action anyway, the Portland Fish Exchange and other entities request. I mean, I had asked that the Yankee Co-op be allowed to do the same thing and was told emphatically no. I think there are a number of entities that are the logical places to have the dockside monitors, not this setup we have now that's incredibly expensive. So, if the makers in the motion will accept that, I'd be happy to vote for it.
But I think what you're basically saying is we want to revisit that section of the regs and fiddle around with it instead of getting into this group and this group but not that group. And that's where we're going, right?
I would say we probably are.
Yeah. Tom?
Well, I guess... my question is, if you're going to go down this road of trying to figure out exemptions or allowing it, you need to try and or task someone, perhaps, to figure out what it is about some dealers that allows them to be exempt from the dockside monitoring standards as opposed to other dealers, because that's what we're talking about. You know, the Portland Fish Exchange may be a publicly owned corporation. Maybe that's a reason why you're willing to accept that, but if you're going to expand the list, then you need to talk about others. If you're talking about changing the dockside monitoring standards, you've already got built-in 50% this year, I think 20% coverage the second year. It seems a little odd to talk about removing a program you just adopted before we've even started to use it.
Mr. Libby?
I think the key criteria for the request originally was that the exchange did not take possession of the catch. I think that may be the guideline.
Mr. Fair.
Well, they actually do take possession, but they don't take ownership. And I think that's the key. They need a dealer permit to have the fish on the premises, but they don't own the fish. So they have a unique status regarding dealers.
Anyone else on the council? Terry?
Yeah, my intent was just to make a cost-effective and efficient way of accurately monitoring the fish. And we have fish exchange and multiple other stations around New England that are in the business of counting fish, and they ought to be able to way to streamline the process to make these catch shares work and really do the accurate monitoring that we need to do in order to move this sector management process ahead.
Go to the audience, Andy Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd refer the council back to the law enforcement precepts. Got to keep it simple, got to keep it consistent. It's a slippery slope. This is the kind of exemption that will cause problems between the industry and the agency. So I would caution you. Thank you.
Rich Canastra.
Rich Canash, the Whalen City Auction, Boston Auction. If the exemption does go through, I'd like to qualify for it myself. We've been in business since 94, no violations since 94, since we opened. And I am private, not public. And we did 35 million pounds last year between both auctions without any fines. And I think that if it goes forth for Portland, I'd like to also have Boston and Whalen City auction be on this list. And again, I do possess fish. The rule is that when it gets off the dock in my cooler, I am in possession. But I do not own fish. That is correct.
Back to the council. Pat?
Maybe I'm misunderstanding, but it seemed to me the point of the dockside monitoring was to have an independent third-party verification. And if we're saying that, in fact, the dealer is going to be the dockside monitor, then haven't we completely defeated the purpose of the dockside monitoring to begin with? So I guess I'm just not getting this.
Sally?
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how this motion really needs to be crafted, given that the change needs to be made in the plan, not just a straight-up request for an exemption. So I think that something that might be more appropriate is rather than just saying that the council would consider developing ways to exempt the Portland Fish Exchange and other entities, whatever those might be, but rather if there's a desire for the council to reconsider what the standards are for sector monitoring and who might carry them out and how they might do that in a way that considers the situation that was brought forward here with the Portland Fish Exchange and that other dealers feel like there's a way to do it in a more streamlined way, but still maintains that third-party effect that is the foundation of the dockside monitoring. So I don't think that exemption is really what we're looking for right now. Maybe it is, or it doesn't really quite seem appropriate, but rather if there's a way to reconsider some of the standards for dockside monitoring, that might be a more accurate way to look at what might be done through a change in the plan.
Anyone else on the council? Gene.
Yeah, just to follow up on what Pat says, this idea of an independent third party really falls under the general aegis of conflict of interest. And the way I couldn't locate right now the way it may be worded in Amendment 16, but for the scallop observer providers, it just says that no scallop observer provider may have any direct or indirect interest in the fishery that it is monitoring. And so are you asking for an exemption to conflict of interest where there is a a conflict of interest. The fact that that a dealer owns or possesses the fish does not necessarily involve a finding that there's no conflict of interest. I mean, there's obviously an interest in handling that fish, and there's benefits by the dealer and the vessels involved, and whether it's a public entity or quasi-public entity or private entity, there's benefits that accrue to that dealer. And to somehow exempt certain types of dealers from conflict of interest when there is clearly a conflict of interest just doesn't seem to logically fall out. So I think it's going to be a difficult thing to figure out here. This is who we approve as monitors, et cetera, is sort of a discretionary decision on the part of the agency. And to legislate sort of a black and white rule as to what a conflict of interest is or isn't is, I really think, undercuts the whole idea of an independent monitoring service that Pat talked about.
Let me suggest this. I think the expectation that the petitioner or the letter writer had coming into today and what's doable are two different things. I think we've figured out that we can't simply write a letter to Pat and expect that she's going to wave that magic wand she has to remedy this particular situation. I also suggest that this discussion is a lot more complicated or deeper than I think we're willing to give it credit for. I think we're just touching the surface of it right now. Since there's no immediacy or immediate need to take an action on this issue today because there's nothing we can do about it today, I would suggest that those parties interested in continuing to think about this work offline, and perhaps you can come back to the council in June with a refined ask or refined thinking on this issue, and perhaps we can bring it up then. That's just my suggestion. I don't see any other way to really go about it. Terry.
Yeah. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Sally's comments were good, and I think taking that work, what I'd like to do is withdraw the motion and come back to the council at a future date.
Without objection? Okay, the motion is withdrawn without objection. Anything further on the ground for Terry?
Sure, I got two more to bat around, too. The next one is a letter from Barry Gibson, 10E, He wrote the chairman on behalf of the Recreational Fishing Alliance, Stellwagen Charter Boat Association, and the Northeast Charter Captains Association, requesting that the council reaffirm the multi-species party charter control date of March 30th, 2006. So I am going to move to reaffirm the multi-species party charter control date of March 30th, 2006.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Preble. Frank?
Can I ask what it means? If we have the control date in there, and we said somewhere we would deal with it in the next available action, which has been put off a few times, is this just a statement from the council saying it's still there, or are we actually...
I don't think it does anything.
That's what I thought.
I mean, I think it serves as a reminder. It's a feel-good. Pat?
It's a little more than a feel-good. The longer you get away from a control date, the more likely that control date is going to be judged to be stale, and the council won't be able to use it. So a reaffirmation, while not ideal, is at least one way to say, okay, we still intend to use this and put the industry back on notice that we haven't given up on this date altogether.
Doug?
I'm fine. That was a question I was going to ask.
Doug's fine. Mary Beth?
This came up at the Mid-Atlantic on Mackerel, I believe, and they reaffirmed the control date, which isn't going to be used anyway, but it was published in the Federal Register when they did that. So, I mean, it is some kind of action. But I do agree with Pat. I mean, 2006, I'm not sure that it's really going to make much difference by the time we get to this action. But it would publish it, and that would be the result.
So, Pat, if we pass this motion, there's going to be a notice in the Register? Okay. Dave Gatham?
Yeah, I would request that the maker and the seconder consider removing this motion at this time, and because it's not on the agenda. I think there are a lot of people that have entered the party and chatter boat business since 2006 that might like to speak to this if they knew it was going to happen, first of all. And second of all, there might be a lot more people that are thinking about entering the party and chatter boat business as they get driven out of the commercial business and might like to speak to this if they knew it was going to be done. So that would be my suggestion anyway, put it on the agenda for June so that people can be notified.
Turn to General Counsel, Dave. You bring up a point. I want to get some advice.
This is kind of a real fuzzy notion, this idea of reaffirming a control date. I mean, a control date is just an advance notice of proposed rulemaking. I wasn't aware that the Mid-Atlantic did this. It seems kind of bizarre that we would put another notice of notice of proposed rulemaking in it, but in the Federal Register, because it really has no force. In the beginning, it has no force. I mean, the original control date has no force and effect of law. This is even less close to that conclusion. It's really taking an action that has no real or practical consequence other than to show that the council, I guess, is still intending at some point in time to look at this issue of charter party boats and limited access measures. So, you know, as a practical matter, it probably doesn't matter whether it's on the agenda or not. I sympathize with what David is saying, that it, you know, if there's some other ulterior message sent by this, that it would be good to have it discussed and noticed up, and so that the public can understand what is meant by this reaffirmation that may go beyond the statement that we're reaffirming the control date. We do ask for public comments on advance notices of proposed rulemaking. I don't know if that was the case with if it did happen in the Mid-Atlantic, as Mary Beth suggested. But I think it would be worth putting it on the agenda at the next council meeting just for further discussion to see where the council may be going with this. But I don't necessarily see any legal reason why you can't take the action today, as long as you follow it up with additional discussion and notice.
Council? Mr. Libby?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Does anyone know how many of these party charter operations there are right now?
We don't have the numbers in front of us, but there's reporting requirements. Tom does. Tom has the numbers in front of him.
Yeah, Dr. Thunberg put a pretty extensive section in Amendment 16 that describes the party charter permit trends. The number of Northeast Region party charter permits increased from multi-species permits, to be more exact, increased from 652 in 2001 to 762 in 2007. That doesn't necessarily indicate that they were all fishing. The number of groundfish, well, the number of report, let me make sure. Anyway, there's a whole bunch of this stuff in Amendment 16. The number of reporting vessels, meaning they filed logbooks and indicated they made trips, was 299 in 2001. In 2007, which was the last year, it was 269. The number of groundfish trips is roughly constant at about 5,800 in 2001 to 5,600 in 2007. Number of anglers had declined from 136,000 in 2001 to 109,000 in 2007. It's a lot of entry in and out over the course of the years. There are about 87 permits that operated from the whole period, 2001 to 2007. And then, you know, that it changes every year, the number that move in and out, gradually increased over the time period for the active fishermen. I mean, I could throw some of this on the board, but it goes at length. I think you get the idea. We have a pretty good idea of how many permits there are. There has been a gradual increase. It fluctuates from year to year. I think the problem facing the operators is that there's been an increase, but the number of passengers is not increasing, and so they're competing for fewer passengers.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this has been a good discussion. I would also say that, you know, from the standpoint of, I would say, process standpoint, I know that when the permits are renewed, the paperwork indicates the control date right up front. So it's not like people are totally unaware of this. But in an effort to keep this whole process as transparent as possible, I would make a motion that we table this till the June council meeting and put it on the agenda as a groundfish item.
Clear second. By Dave Preble, non-debatable. All those in favor, tabling the motion. Seventeen unanimous. Anything else, Terry? You have another one, huh?
Sure, I'm on a roll this morning. this is my last issue, and actually it's resultant after discussions with many fishermen after digesting Framework 44 and how to make the sectors work. Choke species, and the big choke species now, and at least in the Gulf of Maine, the one that I hear the most about is winter flounder. And so I'm going to make a motion to request that the regional administrator initiate an emergency action to implement a zero possession limit for Gulf of Maine winter flounder.
Is there a second? Seconded by Jim Odlin. Discussion. Dave Gatham.
You know, I'm sympathetic to the motion. It's definitely going to shut the sectors down, but isn't this the whole purpose of sectors? I mean, you know, the vultures come home to sit on the post, folks. You know, people don't have any winter flounder. The real problem is that we've accepted a stock assessment that and used it when the best advice we had from the scientific community was not to use it. And then we crafted a number from it that's ridiculously low. The real solution is to put more fish back on the table. It's not to outlaw possession of them. I mean, this is, somehow we went from 4,000 tons to 130 or something like that. I mean, it's crazy. And, you know, I have never supported zero possession limit. I don't see it as a solution to a problem. Tossing fish over the side doesn't fix anything. If anything, I think it makes it worse. I don't care if it's wolffish, southern New England yellow flounder, or northern New England yellow flounder, pout or anything else. All it does is put dead fish on the bottom. So I'm not saying how I'm going to vote on this at the moment because I'm not sure. But I am expressing a great deal of frustration here with a number that is so small that people have things like 3 pounds, 5 pounds. You know, you talk about going out and making one tow for and being done for the year with pollock. Well, you better make a short one for winter flounder you know, for fish, not for winter flounder. You don't even bother fishing for them, but you better make a short tow period because you're going to have more winter flounder in your first tow than most people have got for the year.
Nominees?
I'm not sure the motion really does what the maker, at least what I think the maker wants the motion to do, is written now. The first is that it's not, I think it's implied, but I'm not sure it's clear that it means zero possession limit for both common pool and sector vessels. But I think what's also not stated in the motion is that going to a zero possession limit, I think, is only part of what he's proposing, because I think what he's also meaning is that, much like southern New England winter flounder, window pane, and ocean pout, he doesn't want to have an allocation to the sectors that they're bound to stay within. And I'm not convinced that a zero possession limit alone gets rid of that allocation to the sectors. In other words, you'd have a zero possession limit, you would still track the discards, and when the sector's ace of winter flounder was reached, they'd still be shut down. So I don't think the motion actually does what Terry's proposing or what he wants to do.
Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, just I agree with Tom Neese's characterization of the nature of the problem. The motion doesn't get to where we need to go. There are choke species. They will have tremendous implications and effects on sector success this coming fishing year. I won't support the motion if for no other reason than I'm against, as a matter of philosophy, a zero possession limit. I'm not pleased with what we did with winter flounder southern New England, and I don't want to see that strategy duplicated in the Gulf of Maine.
Jim Allen.
Yeah, first I'd like to perfect the motion, if it's okay with the permit, and to add after flounder and a zero and zero allocation period. Okay, and then I'd like to make a comment, if that's all right, Mr. Chairman. Okay. My comment is that this is exactly what we did in southern New England. The tack in southern New England is about, I'd say, four times more than the Gulf of Maine quota. So, you know, if we did it with a tack that's four times higher than this, we ought to treat this the same way. I think we would have, had we have known these numbers at the time we did Framework 16, Amendment 16, but we didn't know. So I support them.
Doug Rupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is an idea that needs to be thought about. There's been one of the concerns I've always had with winter flounder is that we have a stock assessment, which is, they say that it's not supposed to be used for management. Also, this is a new idea to me, and I think we should have, if we're going to consider such a request, I think I'd like to have that on the June agenda item so that we can have a chance to think about this and see if this is what we really want to do at this point in time. So I would like to make a motion to table this.
Is there a second? Seconded by Mike Leary.
Yeah, but the process question point of order. I just had a question. You said to table it. Is it tabling to a time certain or to...
To the June council meeting.
Thank you.
Non-debatable. All those in favor, raise your hand. Twelve. Opposed. Four opposed. Abstentions. One. Motion to table carries 12-4, one abstention. You going to try again, Terry? Dr. Pierce.
Well, I'm not going to swing the bat. However, I am going to call the council's attention to the potential need for us to act sometime this year in preparation for what might be a necessary action for June of 2011. Specifically, it relates to exemptions to sector operation from rules and regulations. I call the Council's attention to the Federal Register that shows the final rule, the April 9th Federal Register, and in particular to comment 77. That relates to the final rule implementing the proposed universal sector exemptions, specifically to the exemption that allows sector vessels to fish in a portion of Area 133, that's the Isle of Shoals area, the Whaleback area, during June. My agency, the Division of Marine Fisheries, sent Pat a comment back in February of this year, expressing our views that the Council inadvertently made a mistake, an important omission, and we actually have exempted sector operations in that area and at that time when Gulf of Maine codfish, spring spawning codfish, but potentially the last spring spawning group or aggregation of codfish, it will be open for sector fishing with no trip limits, subject to whatever the sectors decide to have in place for operation of their sectors. In that comment 77, the service provides a very rational explanation as to why the service was unable to respond to our request that the service change that exemption and not allow sectors to fish in that area come June. We also highlighted the fact that the University of New Hampshire and working with the commercial fishing industry did some research that demonstrates a very active spawning of that spring spawning codfish in that area at that time. Pat in the comment, or the NIMS in the comment, made it clear that potentially the council would have to make a change, but that's subject to further action down the road. The service indicated it didn't have the research in its hands enabling it to consider making a change at that time. And there were some other considerations as well. Well, so potentially we might have to take action on this and recommend a change in that exemption to sector operations. I say potentially because this is a wonderful opportunity for sectors to demonstrate that indeed they do have stewardship qualities, that indeed stewardship of the resource is part of their credo. Some of the sector operations plans indicate that they will work within themselves, within the sectors, to communicate and to stay away from spawning codfish. That's certainly something I hope they can do. So we'll be communicating, the Division of Marine Fisheries will be communicating with sector managers, expressing our concern about this last spring spawning group within the Gulf of Maine, the fact that they can fish on it if they so desire, and we hope that they are able to show some good stewardship and working within their specific sectors avoid that codfish. If after June comes and goes, we determine that indeed it didn't work, that the stewardship was not shown, and that indeed the sector activity within that area was intense, that will provide, I suspect, some rationale for this council to move forward to change that exemption, to make that decision. So I say potential, we wait and see, but I felt it was at least necessary to raise this issue here in this forum to make it clear that it is a very significant issue, a great concern to the Division of Marine Fisheries, certainly us, and certainly to the National Marine Fisheries Service that has made it very clear time and time again the protection of spawning fish, and in particular protection of spawning codfish, is a high priority for the agency.
Thanks, David. Anything further on the groundfish? Mike Leary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope I do better with this than Terry did. I have a motion to offer. Task the council to send a letter to the service asking them to consider funding the groundfish monitoring in the 2012 budget. If I get a second, I will offer some rationale.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Gaethel.
The rationale is we're in a transition period here, and I think if we have enough coverage, both dockside and at sea, and we get it narrowed down, we get the discard rate, and then the following year when we readjust the plans there, we can get the observer coverage even lower at an affordable rate.
Mary Beth.
Is this advocating for funding that we're not really supposed to do? I mean, I think you could write a letter perhaps and not mention the budget, that perhaps request the service as a policy, you know, from a policy perspective, that they prioritize this, but can we actually do it in the way it's currently worded?
Mean Gene, what say you?
Yeah, this would not be appropriate to ask for funding. I'm looking up the provision just to clarify that, so give me a couple minutes.
We could change asking to pleading or begging.
Is begging allowed?
I'm going to need a couple minutes, so you can go
ahead.
Yeah, just while Gene's looking that up, of course, as you know, we have provided funding for 2010. We're fairly confident that we'll be able to provide the same funding in 2011. And it's fully our intention that as long as the funding continues to be in our budget, that we would provide it for 2012 as well. So, you know, we are advocating for the funding to be for Congress to continue to appropriate those funds, and as long as those funds are there, we're going to continue to pay for these things.
Vince.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Maybe this is for Pat, but isn't some of the $45 or $54 million that the President's requesting for catch shares, doesn't that have money set aside for New England for sectors? And would some of that money be able to go towards this, or isn't some of that going towards this anyway?
Right. That's what I said, that we paid for it in 10. We're fairly certain we're going to be able to cover 11. If Congress continues to appropriate the funds, we'll pay for them in 12. Too. Yeah.
Mike.
Okay, change asking to thanking them.
Mary Beth.
Well, it does seem appropriate to perhaps send a letter that would ask the agency to prioritize in their, you know, in 2012, continuing to fund the need for monitoring groundfish in New England. I mean, that way you can kind of get away from the budget thing, and it just reinforces. I mean, the agency hasn't put together a budget for 2012 yet, and the council would just be supporting continuing the funding and as a priority in the region without specifically saying we're asking for money for 2012. What?
Maker-friendly?
Continue to prioritize funding. This will have to be another one of those carefully worded letters, Gene. Okay. Mr. Leary, Mr. Gaethel agree? Without objection? Any comment from the council? Anything further? Ready for the question? All those.
Doesn't have to say in the 2012 budget.
In 2012,
have to say more than what it says at the
moment. You may want it for 2011 too.
It's going to have to be carefully worded, Dave.
I'm sorry. I guess it'll be all right the way it's worded because it doesn't have a date on it now. It could be into perpetuity.
Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. B.
15 opposed, abstentions, one abstention. The motion carries 15 to 0, one abstention. Anything further on the groundfish? Okay, seeing none. Oh, Pat.
A couple of quick announcements. Of course, this is May 1st is this Saturday, so the start of the Amendment 16 management program is Saturday. We're going to have staff available throughout the weekend, and I wanted people to be aware of that. So there will be staff available to take calls and answer questions and resolve any problems that may come up between 9 and 4:30 on both Saturday and Sunday. We've sent a notice to the industry out to that effect. We're asking people to spread the word as much as they can. And the number, should anybody need to call, is 978-281-9315. So we're going to see how this weekend goes and into next week and then make a decision about whether we need to continue that or not beyond this weekend. And then the second announcement is just to let you know that we've had really high levels of discards this past week on Georgia's Bank cod, which caused the tack to spike. And for both the east and the west area, it looks at this point like we're over the quota. After the fact, we'll have to back out the western portion of the area from the entire quota to see whether or not we have, in fact, exceeded the quota in the eastern portion of the area. But I did want to let people know about that. And we did go over on Yellowtail as well a little bit.
Rodney.
Yeah, Pat, could you repeat the last four digits of that number? I didn't quite get it.
Yes, sorry. It's 9315. So 978-281-9315.
Okay, we're going to take an extended break to provide for checkout. So be back here 5 minutes to 11 to start.